Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply. Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply.
You know what I want? I want a top shelf.
Hello and welcome to the Raptors Extra Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Samson Folk, and today I have a very special guest, Ian Levy. He is the senior NBA editor for FanSided, and I've brought him on to talk Kyle Lowry, other pieces he's done that have talked about the impact that big things are going to have on the culture of the NBA, watching as a fan at large, how players are impacted by technology, how technology impacts the game, things of that nature, and, of course, the Raptors series against the Bucks. Ian, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. I guess so we'll kick it off straight away. The Raptors, they played the Bucks last night. They tied up the series 2-2. It didn't seem like the Bucks had a very big adjustment to the big adjustments that the Raptors made in Game 3, talking about Kawhi Leonard on Giannis, Pascal Siakam on Bledsoe, Kyle Lowry on Middleton, things of that nature. What did you like that the Raptors did in Game 4?
I mean, obviously the switching up some of the defensive matchups seemed like it, you know, kind of had a chain reaction, sort of set things in motion, triggered effects down the line. But I think the most visceral difference for the Raptors was obviously the bench, having Serge Ibaka and Van Vliet and Norman Powell play well. Powell's, you know, had some minutes earlier in the, you know, earlier in the series where he was productive. But Van Vliet and Ibaka, you know, have just sort of been next to nothing. And then, you know, having Lowry and Gasol play well in the starting lineup too, you know, like the Raptors have been good enough to kind of get by with everybody else struggling and you know, Leonard just, you know, playing out of his mind. But this is sort of like how the game last night is how the team is designed to work. It's designed to have Leonard and Lowry to some degree sort of as those offensive focal points. But, you know, the ceiling of this team is when everybody's playing well, is when the supporting cast is hitting shots, when multiple players, you know, can attack the defense after it's bent. You know, when Marc Gasol's, you know, pulling opposing bigs, you know, out to the 3-point line and, you know, hitting cutters from the elbows and all those sorts of things. And it felt like this was the first time in a while that we've sort of seen the Raptors the way they're, you know, supposed to look.
So if this is how the Raptors are supposed to look, and we're seeing that for one of the first times we've seen it in these playoffs, obviously the Bucks are responding the same way. If you're the Bucks and you see an optimized Raptors club, in your mind, what is the first thing you go to stymie them?
You know, I think the Bucks, you know, I don't know that the Bucks would look at this game and think of it as sort of giant, as calling for giant tactical changes or calling for, you know, lineup tinkering and that kind of stuff. I think you could make an argument that it might be time for the Bucks to to trim their rotation a little bit. You know, they've been getting such fantastic bench minutes earlier in the series that they've been able to kind of stretch things and play a deeper rotation. But, you know, Bledsoe's struggling. They've been so good when George Hill and Malcolm Brogdon are on the floor together, although not as much last night. You know, Nikola Mirotic's his defense has been an issue. And so it might be time for the Bucks to kind of identify those two or three lineups that they feel most strongly about and really just lean into those lineups, play as many minutes as they can with those groups that they feel like they have an advantage with, and not worry so much about trying to buy rest for everybody here and there with different lineups. But, you know, I think the Bucks will also look at this and say, all right, it was on the road. You know, what are the given what we've seen from the Raptors in the playoffs, you know, what are the odds that Gasol and Lowry and Van Vliet and Ibaka are going to all play like this on the same night again? And so, you know, it's one of those things where the Bucks, you know, that's how they built this team, and so they've got to feel confident that those guys are going to perform. And you know, I think the Bucks have to feel confident about the track record of those guys together and the track record of their players together. And so, I think there might be some smaller adjustments, some smaller you know, rotation tinkering for the Bucks, but I don't think this really calls for any big changes for them.
I was surprised specifically that they didn't move away from Mirotić in the starting lineup and go to Brogdon, who, like you alluded to, has been very good in this series. I guess you're suggesting that maybe just sticking with a confident approach for the Bucks, trying to maintain winning at home, going into game five, making sure that you maintain the home court advantage and that the Raptors don't have an opportunity to close you out in six. Adversely, the Raptors, if they want to win, if they want to dominate the Bucks in Game 5 and really, really take a big step forward towards going to the NBA Finals, what do you think they have to do?
I mean, they have to play with the sort of energy and effort that they played with in Game 4. I mean, they need those bench players to be efficient and to hit open shots, but they also just sort of looked more aggressive and more involved than they have been in other games in the series. And one of the things I looked at as I was putting together the recap for the game last night was the Bucks. If you look at the first three games in the series, they had these enormous advantages with their bench scoring, with points in the paint, and with fast break points. And that's, you know, those are Milwaukee's strengths. Those have been their strengths all season long. Everybody knows about the three pointers, but I think that's to a greater degree, that's the foundation of the team, is, you know, is depth, is Giannis scoring inside, you know, dribble penetration, you know, getting inside, getting shots at the rim, and then pushing the ball in transition. And so, you know, the Bucks had something like an edge of you know, an average of like 17 points per game, you know, in bench scoring so far in the series. And they were like, you know, an average of plus 10 per game in both points in the paint and fast break points. And in game four, the Raptors bench outscored the Bucks bench by 15 and essentially played them even in fast break points and points in the paint. And so, yeah, I think some of that is strategic stuff and guys hitting shots, but, you know, points in the paint and fast break points is energy and effort. It's getting back intelligently. It's, you know, making sure they've got bodies in front of Giannis. It's making sure they're not losing shooters in transition on cross matches and things like that. And so, you know, I think the Raptors have a game plan they want to play. They need guys to hit shots, and then they just sort of, you know, they need to be on it. They need to be confident. They need, you know, every guy to sort of be active and invested.
Right. So now we've laid out the roadmap for both teams. Let's say, let's get a little bit more granular. You wrote a big piece about Kyle Lowry in the playoffs, how he's been affected by it relative to his performances in the regular season. On average, how great a player he is, how great he needs to be going forward. And that was a piece for Nylon Calculus. And you cited DRE as a statistic and showed Lowry's comparative distribution through the regular season and the playoffs. Two questions. What makes DRE a useful statistic in your eyes? What's the utility of it? Mm-hmm. And you didn't provide an answer, let's say, in your piece for Lowry's game, but more of a call to action. is there a clear way forward for Lowry to reach his regular season level of impact in the postseason?
I'll start with DRE. Obviously it's not a perfect metric. I don't think there are any perfect metrics out there, but it's built off regularized adjusted plus minus, which is also called RAPM, which is sort of an ancestor of real plus minus. It's that ESPN uses. It's sort of a predecessor to that. So the idea with real plus minus is you're looking at lineup statistics and players on and off, and the impact that certain players have, on their team's net point differential when they're in the game, and you're using some complicated math calculations to account for the quality of the competition and to account for the other four guys that are on the floor. You know, so if Kyle Lowry's only playing minutes with Kawhi Leonard, he's going to look better, sort of regardless of how he plays, than, you know, if he's only playing with Norman Powell or whatever it is. So RAPM has proven to be one of the best out of sample predictors. So it's a stat that on an individual player level, people can quibble with certain things, but by and large, it's been one of the best statistics in terms of projecting who's going to win. And I think that's sort of the most useful test of an all-in-one metric. So anyway, that's sort of the basis. And then DRE is a related stat. It was developed by Kevin Farragan for Nylon Calculus. And what it does is it uses RAPM, and it sort of, I don't want to say this, it works it down to a single game level, and it builds it on box score statistics. So it says, we can't calculate RAPM for a single game. We don't have a big enough sample to do that complicated formula to sort of account for all the other factors, with one game's worth of data. So what we do is we take things like points and rebounds and shot attempts and misses and things like that, and we figure out how those relate to a player's RAPM over an entire season, and then we can we can convert that down to a single game level. So there's, as far as I know, there's really only DRE and game score, which Basketball Reference uses. Those are sort of the only other single game metrics. And game score is built off all of the same statistics. It's still just box score stuff, points, rebounds, steals, turnovers, things like that. But game score has sort of arbitrary weights. It's just sort of a guess at how much a point is worth or how much a block is worth, whereas DRE is trying to estimate how much each of those things are worth based on how they affect this other sort of larger global statistic. And it's pretty complicated, but the too long didn't read version is it's a single game metric based on a player's box score stats that's very good at sort of estimating a player's overall impact.
Perfect. And like you mentioned in the piece, that's DRE was very, very, I guess, good to Kyle Lowry in the regular season. He performs really well in that metric. He's decent enough in the playoffs, as has been, the much to the chagrin of Raptors fans, the narrative around Kyle Lowry for a long time has been that he doesn't perform in the playoffs. And for the longest time, he has been the most important Raptors performer, and he has been generally the best player on the team. However, he hasn't been performing to the level that he performs in the regular season, so there is still a drop-off. Like you noted in your piece, that happens for a lot of players, but for Kyle Lowry, he's operating in a lower percentile than usual, and maybe more so than we see from all-star players.
I think that's one of the things that's sort of hard, because I didn't run the study on every player. But I think in general, if you looked at a bunch of different players, you would sort of see that pattern. The playoffs are harder. You're playing against a tougher level of competition. Fewer minutes for bench players. There's sort of all these factors that make the playoffs, a bigger challenge. And so I think in general, you would see a similar trend for everybody. My guess is it's less pronounced for, elite star players. But I just thought, it was not necessarily putting Lowry's in context and saying this is, you know, much worse than we would expect. I just wanted to sort of illustrate that, like, this is a real thing, this is a real effect, and this is what it looks like. So I don't have the article open, but if I remember correctly, the finding was like, what constitutes a very good game for Kyle Lowry in the regular season, you know, the kind of game that he has one out of every five games, you know, that sort of a very strong game, that happens about one out of every seven times in the playoffs. So, you know, he about 50% less often is he hitting this, you know, this level of a very strong level of performance that he does often in the regular season. And so I also was trying to avoid assigning it to any specific reason, because I think to some degree it's unfair to Lowry that this decline is usually assigned to some sort of vague generic flaw that he has. You know, he's not a playoff performer, he, you know, doesn't have the mental fortitude to show up for big games or whatever it is. And I think really if you look at his playoff stats series by series, you can see you know, it's a combination of a bunch of different factors. You know, we've had series where he's a little banged up. You know, you have series where it just happens to be a really bad matchup. You have series where, you know, everybody else on the team is struggling as well, and that makes his job harder. You have series where, yeah, he, you know, he probably did, you know, feel the moment a little bit, or maybe miss some shots that he normally makes. But you also have series where he's played really well. He has, you know, it has not been a consistent one-to-one trend. You know, he has had some playoff series where he's played really well, potentially even better than he did during the regular season. So I thought it was an interesting way to sort of highlight this trend that, yeah, it is real. It is a big thing, but it's not as specific as he's always bad in the playoffs. It's just, you know, every player has this sort of distribution of good games and bad games, and his distribution is just a little bit shifted to the left when we get to the playoffs.
Right, and I guess since we're addressing, he's hitting it less often, but in this series against the Bucks, he's been sublime. He's been very, very good. Looking at this series and then thinking back to maybe a Wizards series that he wasn't very good in 2015, is there any stark contrast? And I know you didn't want to get into very specific things, but is there something that doesn't play armchair psychologist and guesstimate at his mental fortitude? Is there some sort of gamesmanship that you notice a difference in from a good Kyle Lowry series and a bad Kyle Lowry series?
I mean, I really hesitate to ascribe it to mental factors because I think it's the hardest thing to measure. And it's too vague. There's too many, there's too many sort of weird variables in there that are sort of harder to control. I think the thing that's most obvious to me is how much better he has become as a three-point shooter. And it's easy to forget how much his game has sort of evolved in these 7 years he's been in Toronto. I just pulled up his basketball reference page. So, like, if you look at his first 3 years in Toronto, he shot about 36% on three-pointers with about 5.5 attempts per game. And if you look at his next three seasons, so not this year, but last year and the three before that, he's shooting about 38% with about 6.5 attempts per game. And so obviously his three-point percentage was down quite a bit this year, but the attempts were still high. But I think he's just a different player than he was earlier in his career. You know, early on in this run with DeMar DeRozan, his skill set has evolved in a way that makes him more ideal as a complementary scorer. So as his athleticism has declined a little bit, he's become a much more comfortable and confident three-point shooter. So you have the variable of Leonard sort of being a better and more efficient pick and roll and isolation scorer than DeRozan was, and sort of drawing more defensive attention that way. And then Lowry's sort of been better suited to leverage that as well. So, you know, where the Raptors might have sort of always been better off with him kind of being the second fiddle to DeRozan, they have a better first fiddle now, and Lowry's skill-wise is in a better place to take advantage of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. 100% agree with that. And so we'll move on from Lowry now, and we'll go on to Kawhi Leonard. Your piece you penned, I think it was 2016, the next level of managing NBA player minutes. So, being that this is a Raptors podcast, and Kawhi Leonard has been on the Raptors this year, and the Raptors conversation has been entrenched in this long, long conversation about load management. What is your opinion on how the Raptors handled Kawhi's rest, thinking back to that piece you wrote about managing NBA player minutes?
So the idea of that piece is that the idea of that piece was that, you know, sort of talking about the Spurs specifically, and their you know, it's sort of become commonplace now. A lot of teams have borrowed this strategy, but you know how they worked on reducing the load on their star players. And one of the things that was sort of an interesting effect of that was as their you know, as their best players, as the Spurs' best players were aging, you know, obviously Kawhi was sort of on another generational track being younger, but you know, as Tim Duncan and Manu Ginobili and Tony Parker were aging, in addition to reducing minutes to kind of save their bodies and keep them fresh, they were also, you know, on a per possession basis a little bit less effective than they had been when they were in their primes. And so the minutes when they were on the floor were less of an advantage or less of a margin for the Spurs. And, you know, as hard as it is to find, you know, star players, you know, it can be hard to find, you know, a good sixth, seventh, or eighth man. But the Spurs have always been really good at that. They've always made sure that they have positive players coming off their bench. And so, you know, fewer minutes for their stars means more minutes for, you know, guys six, seven, eight, nine off the bench. Because the Spurs had really positive players there, they were giving more minutes to those guys, and they often ended up with this big bench advantage because those players were so much better than other teams' 6, 7, 8, 9 guys. So it was a combination of just sort of the design of the roster and then how they leveraged it to get value out of it. So in terms of Kawhi and the Raptors, I think that's how the Raptors envisioned their team this regular season. I think obviously you know, the emergence of Pascal Siakam sort of made it much easier to go with that. But they were really careful managing his minutes, keeping the load small, you know, holding him out of games for rest and load management throughout the season. And I think it worked really well. Where it has broken down a little bit in the playoffs is, you know, they don't have OG Anunoby. The trade for Marc Gasol, you know, while they probably made the right bet in that his you know, his skills raised their ceiling slightly, I think by essentially making a 2-for-1 swap there, you know, they got Gasol, but they sent out Valanciunas and DeLon Wright. You know, so that cut their depth a little bit because they lost another sort of capable you know, bench player there. So that shortened things up a little bit. Anunoby being out, and then their bench players just struggling, I think that advantage has just not manifested in the way that they were maybe hoping in the playoffs.
Right. And so Kawhi Leonard, obviously, he did save a lot of his energy during the regular season. Mm-hmm. And there was a small subsect of Raptors fandom that was upset with the idea of load management. There are groups around the league, people that don't like it. They want the players to play. I'm of the mind that rest is good, and I like the players saving their bodies, that type of thing. What's your opinion on load management now and how it might look 5 years from now?
I think if anything, we're going to see patterns sort of get more extreme. I understand both sides of the argument, and I think it ultimately comes down to what you value. And I think I think for what a team's goals are, you cannot expect them to do anything thing other than, you know, these load management plans. I think the incentives for a team are not to put the best product on the floor every single night. The incentives at the team level are driven towards competing for championships. And, while there might be some sort of like minor revenue loss by, you know, having Kawhi Leonard out for a home game or something like that, you know, maybe they are selling fewer tickets and selling fewer hot dogs in the arena. The difference between, you know, the difference for Toronto in terms of revenue between, you know, how last year's playoffs ended and if they finish this year, you know, with a title or, you know, pushing the Warriors to six or seven games and really, you know, sort of making them sweat and getting beat at the end, that I think pays off so much more in revenue in terms of national attention, you know, drawing in national fans, more exposure for the team. And I'm sure that drives, advantageous sponsorship arrangements and things like that. And so, you know, at the team level, the incentives are tilted towards the big picture and not the game to game. And I know for fans, it kind of stinks because when you're buying a ticket, your incentives are just on, you know, that game, you know, when you take your kids to go see a game on a Thursday night, you know, it doesn't really matter to you if they're going to win the championship or not. You want to have a good time that evening. And, you know, it might stink to you know, watch Malachi Richardson go out there and take 20 shots or whatever it is. But, I don't think there's any way to sort of resolve that perfectly. I think that tension is always going to be there. And while it's frustrating, I don't think it's fair to make teams de-incentivize the big picture and you know, put the best players on the floor every night to the detriment of their long-term hopes. And, you know, like even for a team that's not necessarily competing for a championship, the incentive is still there to take care of their best players so that they're there next year, you know, and that their careers are long and healthy and productive. And even if it's somebody who's not going to be on the team long-term, you know, so that they still have value as a trade asset or something like that. You know, I don't think players getting hurt or worn down or sort of broken down with overuse, I don't think that benefits anyone. I think that tension's always going to be there. I don't think there's any way to sort of resolve it. But if anything, I think we're going to see more. I think we're going to see teams be more and more judicious with how they use players and how often they use players.
Yeah, I think most of the change and the compromise will come on the part of the fans who will just kind of grow accustomed to it.
Yeah.
Because they feel invested in the team's greater goal of a championship or success. So moving on from Raptor-centric stuff, I think it was, I remember Kurt Goldsberry, he was an author of it, but Bose Gusters, You wrote an article about that paper and the research they did on that. Do you mind giving us the cliff notes of it? And then I'm going to ask some questions based off of that.
This was a paper that was presented at the Sloan Conference. And I want to make sure I'm talking about the right paper because there's been a couple iterations, but this is the one I believe where they have the authors had developed sort of an iPad app, and the app took real-time tracking data and made estimations based on the players that were on the floor, their specific offensive and defensive tendencies on both sides, game situation stuff, how much time was left on the clock, how many fouls people had, how many minutes they'd played, sort of expected exhaustion, pretty much every factor that you could you would sort of want included was baked into this calculation. And so what a coach could do on the sideline was they could draw a play on the iPad app, and the app would return an expected point value for that play that they had drawn. And so, you know, if it wasn't high enough, the coach can erase it and start over and draw another play until they sort of come up with, what seems like the best way to, you know, attack an out of timeout situation or something like that. Coaches probably have a lot of that information in their heads anyway, and they're making those sorts of calculations, by gut, and the best coaches are, have pretty great guts, and, they're making the right call more often than not, just based on their sort of innate understanding of the situation. But having this kind of system just gives a little bit more information. It quantifies it in a way that maybe is a little bit useful. And then the application that was most interesting to me was, if you sort of take this system down the road, eventually eventually, I would imagine you could have the program, instead of the coach inputting the plays and the system grading it out, you could have the system just spit out the best play, the play that has the most the most expected value. And then once that part of the system's built, then shouldn't be too far of a stretch to have a comparable system that comes up with the best defensive strategy to defend the optimal play. And then from that point, it's like, well, then maybe we don't even need coaches for strategy stuff. We can have algorithms that sort of measure out the ideal way to attack or defend in all these different sort of situations and game scenarios.
I like that you pointed out that a lot of coaches, they go with their gut feeling, because there is, in the back of your mind, your head is, or your brain is making a lot of calculated risks, going through a lot of scenarios itself. You're just not putting a voice to them. Uh-huh. How much value do you think can be derived from those algorithms? And do you think that, provided that they were really, really good and they were applicable and they worked, which would be incredible, and already the premise that the app has already made is incredible to be this far anyway, but do you think that players would be receptive to an algorithm spitting out plays for them to run?
I mean, I think it's all in delivery and application. Like, obviously, like, one of the most obvious issues with the program as it was presented in that paper is, a coach calls a timeout, in the fourth quarter to try and design a play. They might only have, 2 minutes of time to, to try and draw up these plays on the app and get a return. And then, no, that's not good enough. I'm going to draw it again. So it's not like they have infinite time to sort of, milk all of the value out of this algorithm. They have what the game structure allows, the timeout that the game structure allows. I think, as far as like what players are going to accept, I think players want to play basketball, and I think they will adapt to all sorts of things. I mean, like when you think about how far, how far the management of a player's lifestyle has come, and I don't mean to imply that it's all directed by the team. It's things that agents are coaxing them into, and trainers, and things that the players want to do themselves because they want to be better. But you think about the 60s and 70s, where you might have guys smoking cigarettes in the locker room after a game, or Kevin McHale and Larry Bird drinking beer after a game, to the kind of nutrition routines that players go through now, and the kind of the kind of biometric, testing and tracking that teams are doing in practice and things of that nature. And, like every piece of this evolution, I think you'll have early adopters who are eager for every edge. You will have people who sort of go along with it, and you'll have, people on the end who, complain and moan, either because they don't understand it or, they have some other sort of resistance to it. But it just keeps moving. And, eventually, the people who are resistant become the reluctant adopters, and the reluctant adopters become the, enthusiastic adopters. And, I think all of these things just sort of move along. And, another underrated aspect is, players don't have a ton of choice on these kinds of team things. Some of these things are collective bargained, but if a team, if a general manager and a coach decide they're going to use a computer algorithm to design a play, the players, I don't think, really have a recourse to protest. And, if the algorithm designs a play that results in a missed shot, the players, might complain afterwards, but that happens even when coaches draw up a play and somebody is in the locker room afterwards, you know, throwing shade because they didn't get the last shot or because the, you know, they didn't have a chance to be on the floor for the final possession or whatever it is. I think a lot of this stuff just applies to everything. It applies to technology and human coaches.
So I guess following the brainwave of computer learning, these types of things, technology going forward in basketball, seeing how the NBA 2K League has progressed and the growing culture of enjoying video games as a viewing rather than a participant, do you think we're moving closer to an artificial league that is run by code and simulation?
So I posed that question. I had the column. I wrote a column about this just because I was curious about the idea of it. And I don't necessarily know, but the idea was, you know, from taking from this Boastcuster system and you know, a bunch of other, sorts of machine learning algorithms and things that are working on tracking data. It seems like we're getting closer and closer to being able to model the inherent complexity of a basketball game. And, you know, we're also seeing enormous growth in video graphics and CGI stuff in movies. So it doesn't seem like a stretch to imagine that, you know, at some point in the future, in the not too distant future, technology would be able to create a visual environment that was essentially indistinguishable from reality. And so if we have those two pieces, you know, if we can create a simulated basketball game that looks real, completely real, and has all of the complexity of an actual basketball game, then we sort of have both halves, and we could create, you know, a simulated basketball environment that could compete with reality. And I think there's really interesting, implications, like when you think about player health, you know, would then not be a concern unless that was something they, you know, it would be kind of cruel. But if we're going to create a simulated environment, you know, where we want to factor in players getting hurt and bodies breaking down, but you know, you wouldn't have to deal with so many other problems. You wouldn't have to deal with travel. You know, you wouldn't have to deal with travel, both the effect of the players and the associated costs. I mean, you think about potentially how much cheaper it might be. Obviously, this technology would be complicated, but how much cheaper it would be in the end run to do this as opposed to, you know, managing 30 arenas with, you know, 30 arena staffs and you know, all of the pieces that go into it. Obviously, there's some horrifying ramifications as well. The idea that, you know, humans are less and less important and useful, and essentially we could, you know, simulate sports, which is one of these entertainment places that seems like it's has been held out for humans. But yeah, I feel like it's something that is going to be more and more realistic, more and more plausible. And, you know, it's something that the league will have to sort of reconcile at some point.
My first question, hearing all of that, is I do think about, like, League of Legends tournaments, things like that. There's tons of people packed in a stadium, but there still is the human interaction. The medium for that is the game console, but there's still, you know, a person operating it, using the medium. In basketball, it's the court, it's the ball, that's the medium, and then everybody rotates around that playing the way that they play. Same goes for the video game, and there's a reactionary thing. And the reaction is based on how humans interpret what they're seeing and react to it. Mm-hmm. If it's just simulation, does moving away from humans interacting with the medium as participants and simply only watching it, does that completely change the fabric of it? Or do you actually think that we might, you know, in our heads say, this is entertainment, this is what we came to see, if there's not human investment into it?
I think that's a psychological barrier that would have to be overcome. Was, you know, I think, you know, from a functional point of view, there's no real difference for a viewer between watching, an E-League, NBA Live game or NBA 2K game that is totally simulated versus one that is, you know, human players, you know, controlling the avatars on the screen. You know, for a viewer, the only difference is that you know that one of them is controlled by humans, and so it's a mental construct that separates those two things. And so I think that would be a challenge for people. You know, you already, I think you have a lot of people who are like, why would I want to watch two people play a video game of basketball when I could watch an actual basketball game? But we're already seeing that that barrier is breaking down. There's more and more people who are comfortable just watching, you know, an NBA 2K game with this, you know, the NBA's 2K league. And I think eventually it wouldn't take too much to break down that the other construct of, you know, instead of knowing that there's five humans somewhere controlling those players and talking on headsets, and me being able to hear them talk, I'm just gonna watch it and I don't know who's controlling it.
I wonder. I'm not trying to be an antagonist in this, but no, I wonder, dating back to the Colosseum and just how entertainment and sport and the physical part of it has been attached to it. And then eventually we're starting to look at like 2K, it's not physical, but it's the skill that's attached to it.
Yeah.
If you take that facet out of it, it's tough for me to imagine that people would be able to identify with it. But I totally, I understand you saying like, as a viewer, it's completely the same. You're watching the same product. It's just nobody's interacting with it the same way. But they also they have like the team cams. They have like specific cams so you can see the player's reaction. You can see how they're working, all that type of things. It's just, I don't even know if I have a question posed for you. That's just, it's very, very interesting for me.
Yeah, I think the NBA 2K League is sort of a bleeding together of these two things because, so again, I don't watch it and it's still kind of a foreign environment for me or a foreign world for me. But my understanding is that if you're watching that NBA 2K League, you're not invested in the computer. You're not invested necessarily in the outcome of the computer game. You're invested in the outcome of the five humans on each side, and the game is just sort of the mediums, you know. So if you're watching, I don't know if I'm capturing it in the right words, but like if you're watching an NBA 2K League game, you're watching a competition between two sets of five humans playing a game. You're not watching for the basketball necessarily, if that makes sense. You know, the basketball might be an interesting medium, but that's not the game. But I think it's giving people an experience where they're watching, you know, computer avatars essentially play the game. And I think it all just sort of erodes that psychological barrier. You're right. I think people are watching now because it's a contest of human skill, but the manifestation of the human skill is computer avatars, you know, existing in this fictional environment. And as people get more and more comfortable and more familiar with that, I think it's it'll be easier to sort of, you know, if somebody wanted to slowly remove the human element until it's, you know, it's not there anymore.
Yeah, that's believable. For the longest time, it has, like you said, a contest of human skill. But the way that entertainment is changing and growing, it could just be that we're not worried about what produces it. We're just worried about the end game and what it looks like at the end. That's very interesting. Yeah. I feel like that's as good a place to step off of it as any. Thank you so much for coming on, man. This has been great.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Yeah, great conversation. Happy to come on again if you ever need somebody.
Yeah, feel free to shout out wherever you're doing your writing. Obviously, Fansided, but your Twitter, things like that, where people can follow you.
You can find my stuff on fansided.com/NBA. That's the home of the Step Back and Nylon Calculus. And you can find me on Twitter at Hickory High.
Perfect. Ian, thank you so much for coming on. And to all the listeners, thank you for listening and have a blessed day.
Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply. Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply.